Hello, and welcome to episode 152 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Chip Davis, President and CEO of Sibley Memorial Hospital, former Vice President of Innovation and Patient Safety at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Chip is also the former owner of R.O. Davis Construction and has long been a member of the faculty at Johns Hopkins University. Chip, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Doing great, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to ask is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
So both Sibley and now being a member of Johns Hopkins Medicine, I think, has a very unique opportunity in the Washington area to do just that. Mm-hmm. Sibley has a 125-year history in the Washington area of serving the public, if you will, in the public interest and the public good. We have about 2,200 people that work here, mm-hmm. and I can tell you that I truly believe that all 2,200 people come in every day wanting to do the right thing,
right.
To serve their fellow man. Now, also with the opportunity becoming a member of the family of Johns Hopkins Medicine,
right.
Johns Hopkins certainly has a storied history of doing the same thing, and our organizations, I think, have a great fit to do that.
So you have an interesting path that brought you here. You actually came to Johns Hopkins to do building management, having come from your own business as an entrepreneur. Can you speak a little bit about transitioning from construction and being self-employed to coming to one of the largest private employer in the state of Maryland?
Sure. Well, my path to owning my own business and doing construction was one of just survival. I went through school and worked my way through school. Mm-hmm. My dad was in construction. My mom was actually a nurse. And I worked through college doing construction. And then afterwards, as I was going to graduate school, in order to not be a pauper grad student, I had to work. What I realized probably about halfway through college is I could actually make more money by having people work with me and work for me. So I formed a little company and started out painting and then doing other kinds of different construction
things. As a student, you were an employer.
Yes. when I went to the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. Go Blue. And when I came down to Washington, to be an NIH research grant right out of undergraduate school. And I thought I was going to, move to the big city and live the high life that's on $17,500 a year, which was my salary from NIH. And to make a long story short, I quickly realized after a few months that that wasn't going to cut it.
Uh-huh.
So I started to moonlight at night doing construction for some of the doctors and others at NIH, and one thing led to another. And I just started to do that by myself, mostly on the nights and weekends. I then got accepted to a master's program.
Right.
I didn't have enough money to go to the master's program, so I told my director at NIH that it had been great, but I needed to go do construction in order to put enough money away to go to grad school.
Yeah.
So I did that. I went away, did my master's. I'd run out of money, so I came back to the D.C. area because I'd had this little company that I'd started, and I did that for another year or two, and got enough money to go back to get my Ph.D., and I ran that company while I was getting my doctoral degree.
So kind of intellectual construction with physical construction simultaneously, the student and entrepreneur.
Well, I hope there was some intellectual construction.
You had this original health interest in health going to the National Institutes of Health.
I did. So my mom was a nurse, mm-hmm. And I actually had open heart surgery when I was 9 years old.
Oh.
So I had spent a lot of time in hospitals. Either with my mom, she was also a professor in the School of Nursing, so I kind of grew up on college campuses and going to hospitals. So I was comfortable in a hospital setting. When I got done, or as I was finishing my doctoral program, mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to take a role at Johns Hopkins with a vice president who had just finished their brand new 450,000 square foot outpatient center, but it wasn't physically done yet. The couple of floors still had to be finished out. So he hired me not because I was a newly minted PhD, but because I had knew something about construction. So it was an opportunity to kind of get in on the inside of administration, and I had always enjoyed the kind of entrepreneurial and management aspects of things. So,
although it sounds like you've been attracted to healthcare, and you've been the reluctant entrepreneur, the reluctant construction man, you've had to fall back on that in order to make ends meet.
I really enjoyed construction. You know, construction's a great thing in terms of it's very creative.
Yeah.
I think there's some similarities to healthcare in terms of your, you know, when you work on someone's home, that's something that's very important to them.
Right.
Very similar to one's health, right?
Mm-hmm.
One's health is very, very important to them. So I think that when you're working with patients or when you're working with customers, if you will, having a service orientation and understanding what their needs and desires are and trying to meet those.
Right.
There's some similarities there, I would say.
So a big hallmark of your leadership at Johns Hopkins Medicine and particularly at Sibley Hospital is your ability to integrate best practices from different industries around the economy and bring it into the hospital, particularly with regards to patient safety and quality of care. You've brought in Lean Sigma and Six Sigma from the automobile industry, and you've also brought in checklists from the airline industry. Can you speak a little bit about how what you've been doing with patient safety and quality of care that has benefited patient outcomes due to the processes that you've drawn upon from throughout society?
Sure. So it was probably about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more, that I started to have the opportunity to get exposed to other high reliability industries, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that I started to look outside of healthcare
mm-hmm.
At those was to try and understand the commonality of those industries and if there were any application to hospitals, health, etc. One of the reasons I started to do that was because as I was trained as a research scientist,
right.
And tend to look at things from that lens. But it appeared to me, mm-hmm. Having been in healthcare as a kind of a young, wet behind the ears administrator at the time, that there were many opportunities to eliminate waste and variability in the way in which we deliver healthcare.
Now, this was a problem that you identified, or were there CEOs of the hospitals who are saying patient safety is out of control, we're having too many...
I think this was even before the patient safety movement.
Right. So you
in healthcare
found
this? No, I wouldn't say I found it. I think that there were... I had the opportunity to get exposed with some senior leaders across the country early on mm-hmm. who were looking outside of healthcare at other industries. That concept, however, made a lot of sense to me. So I, an example, I told you I grew up in Michigan
yeah.
and had friends in the auto industry, and I knew that the auto industry, especially at that particular time, was undergoing significant strife.
Hmm.
One of the things the auto industry did was actually adopt, if you will, the concept of lean manufacturing.
What is that for our listeners who don't know?
Lean manufacturing is something that looks at trying to eliminate waste mm-hmm. from the perspective of the customer. So what ultimately you value. So an example I would give you here at Sibley is that when our leadership of our emergency department designed our new emergency department here, one of the things that they did is they spent a lot of time with patients, asking them what their expectations were, a lot of time with nurses and physicians, etc., trying to understand what the best design might be. They originally had designed the emergency department with a large waiting area. After the director and some of her leaders in the emergency department went through our lean training, she realized that ultimately what the patients really wanted was to be able to come in and directly see a provider.
Right.
So they actually designed the waiting room out of the patient care experience, and they redesigned actually the flow of the care within the emergency department.
And you're talking about the physical design of the ER?
I'm talking about the physical design of the ER. Right?
Which is,
so we have a waiting area, if you will, for the family, but the concept of the patient is you come directly in, are immediately seen by our providers.
And what has been the patient reaction to that new facility?
I think the patient reaction has been great. We're actually, I believe, in the 97th percentile nationally of patient satisfaction. With that. But the concept, again, was from a patient's perspective, what is it that a patient wants? So I would ask you, right, if you're coming into the emergency department, you know, why are you coming there?
Right. You want to get in, get out, get your pain taken care of.
That's right. You don't want to wait, you know, 60 minutes or 30 minutes or 2 hours, if at all possible, to get in. Now, obviously, you know, it is an emergency department and there can be things that are more acute than your particular malady. But again, that's the concept.
So you've been working to, and then, of course, Lean Sigma is something that was practiced by Toyota, which was a competitor of the American auto industry in Michigan.
That's correct.
And so they learn from their competitors. You learn from your kind of exposure.
So actually, the reason that I actually first got exposed to the lean manufacturing was because I was at a meeting of some folks who were trying to look again outside of healthcare. They had a couple guys from General Motors come in and give a little hour talk. It was interesting. And afterwards, I connected with them because we figured out that we were all from Michigan, etc., started to talk to them. And there was an opportunity to work with them.
Interesting.
So we learned from that. We also started to study the airline industry and the applications of the airline industry with the pre-flight checklist and post-flight checklist, if you will, applications of those things in the operating room and the way that catheters are inserted, etc. So it's standardization, if you will, of processes. And then the last kind of component of things that we focused on was also design theory, particularly that came out of the Stanford School of Design, which is a way to idealize, if you will, processes. And the combination of the different methodologies, if you will, are something here at Sibley that we've then been trying to wrap around the patient experience itself.
So one thing that came out of your lessons learned from the airline industry with the checklist is a 5-step checklist for inserting catheters, as you said, and it has chlorhexidine, which is a type of soap, and not every time you're wearing an apron and stuff. And the real application of those lessons that demonstrated that they were efficacious in the healthcare industry and that these lessons were translatable to the healthcare industry was the Michigan Keystone Project. Now, did you have involvement in that project, and was your, you know, background from Michigan a determining factor in any sense for where it should actually be initially played out?
Yeah. So I wasn't actually involved in that process, although my colleague Peter Pronovost was, and it had been some early work that had been done at Johns Hopkins that then Peter had an opportunity to work with the Michigan Hospital Association on that, which was really the first larger scale application of that. There had been colleagues across the country that were absolutely focused on this use of this checklist. I think that Peter then took that from the experience of Michigan Hospital Association, which was truly astounding in terms of its application. Mm-hmm. And then there was a collective effort across the country. Hopkins was certainly involved, and our center was involved, at trying to really get that into all hospitals. And if you look at the application of that, mm-hmm. it's just had astounding results.
So I'd like to ask you to elaborate on that, because the idea of patient safety and quality of care is maybe perhaps somewhat nebulous for some of our listeners.
Sure.
You know, you think, well, patient safety, if I go to a hospital, then surely that's probably the safest place for me, as opposed to being at home and not getting any care at all. Of course, in reality, you could get care at home, and you could, there are iatrogenic diseases mm-hmm. that you can get in a hospital, which means diseases brought to you by the provider. Can you speak for a moment about perhaps the TAERA's Human Report from Institute of Medicine?
Sure.
Just why is patient safety important? Why is quality of care important? And why is making this progress in those fields, why is that helpful to a hospital?
Sure. Well, a couple of things. So I think that if you were to actually come into a hospital and just sit and watch mm-hmm. The care that's provided, first of all, I think that people frequently see the humanity in that, but they also see the complexity of it. It's tremendously complex. You have literally thousands of working parts and people interacting ultimately to deliver that care to that patient. So what we know about healthcare today in the U.S. Is that, and again, regardless of what political party you may be affiliated with, is that today we spend significantly more on healthcare than any other industrialized country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what healthcare economist you want to believe, but significantly more.
And if we pay the most, then we must get the best care, huh?
Well, so that's a great question. Actually, if you take a look at most of the research on this, we tend to be toward the bottom of the industrialized countries.
By Slovakia, so, 37th in the world.
I don't remember exactly where Slovakia is on it, but indeed, we do not demonstrate always that we have the highest levels of care. There's opportunities for improvement significantly. So the Institute of Medicine report that you referenced came out some time ago. And what that report basically said was that over 100,000 patients a year die in this country as a result of errors, quote, within the healthcare system. And those errors can be preventable because many, many of them, over about 80%, are at the time were attributed to miscommunication between providers. And I can tell you, having worked in healthcare for many years, that no one wants to harm a patient.
Right.
These events, while many of them are preventable, are tragic. They're as a result of that and some other advocates within the healthcare industry, there was a huge movement about 10, 15 years ago across all of our hospitals to increase the patient safety, if you will, to minimize those events. And the concept was, how could we do that? The questions that were being asked is, how could we do that? There within this movement, one of the things we started to do was look outside of healthcare at other industries, nuclear power, aviation, auto manufacturing, that had to make a move to high reliability. Now, some of those industries had to make a move because of nuclear power, obviously, safety issues, the auto industry, competitiveness issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we started to apply many of those principles. So the project that you talked about in Michigan, that's a direct application from crew resource management, which is a concept from aviation, mm-hmm. of having a standardized checklist that you follow.
So some of our listeners may be thinking, well, if we're spending so much money on healthcare, yet have poor quality, and we're having all these different negative outcomes in healthcare, and there's so many different problems, well, then why do sheiks come here? Why was, you know, the whole storming of the American embassy in Tehran was because the Iranian Shah came here for healthcare. A lot of people think America has the best healthcare in the world. How do you address that challenge to somebody who says, you know, why are we the beacon of the most wealthy and powerful? Why would they come here? And I think the difference is acute care versus chronic conditions and population health, but maybe you can lend some insight.
Well, I would not want your listeners to think that the United States does not have high quality of care. Mm-hmm. I think that clearly there are phenomenal organizations that deliver high quality care. At the same time, we know that that is not distributed equally across our population. Mm-hmm. We know that there is significant variability of costs, mm-hmm. Significant variability of charges, depending on the regions of the country. If you look at some of the evidence from the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Atlas, et cetera, it shows that variability. So what I would say is I think there's significant opportunity for improvement, however. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll give you an example. I recently had the opportunity to travel with the mayor of D.C. to Cuba, and we went to a small clinic in Havana, of which there's many within Havana. That's one of their public health measures. Mm-hmm. And the Ministry of Health was there, and they were very proud to share with us that their infant mortality was now lower than the United States, according to their statistics. And they showed us the trend over a period of years. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating because how they did that was every pregnant woman gets 12 to 14 prenatal visits. And if mom does not show up for some reason, they reach out to her to make sure that she comes in. Now, that is not an expensive, necessarily, proposition. It is a best practice model. But again, we know that that does not happen across all of our populations in the U.S. So I think that... the other thing that we're now starting to see is with the advent of technology, with the application of, I think, some of these performance improvement tools, if you will, within hospitals and organizations, you are starting to now see care move from acute hospital settings into outpatient, or as you said earlier, into homes. And that's a good thing from the standpoint of if indeed patients can recover more quickly, don't need to be in a hospital, you know, it is safer for them because hospitals can have bad bugs, if you will, even though we have put a tremendous amount of effort into infection control, those things can happen. And I think you're going to see the industry move away from higher cost care into lower cost settings, if possible, if applicable. Good example of that that's happening here at Sibley today is we have a certain cohort of patients who now have same-day hip replacement surgery. So you come in the morning, and you go out in the afternoon with a new hip, walking out and recovering in your own home. That's very different than just a few years ago, where that would be a two-week stay within the hospital.
I can tell you're very proud of that accomplishment. And as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask you a final question, which is essentially to reflect on your accomplishments within the context of your interesting career. Now, many individuals listening to this podcast are participants in a changing economy. Unlike decades ago where you would enter the workforce and have one career trajectory, now many individuals shift and you have many different people making multiple shifts in their careers throughout their lifetime, and then many individuals are bringing different lessons and different perspectives from each industry into the next experience that they have. I'd like to ask you to reflect for a moment on your varied career, on the experience that you've had in construction and what you brought into medicine, and why all of that, why the end goal of improving the world and advancing the public interest is something that has been important to you, and what at the end of the day you hope your legacy will be in healthcare and in the world through your efforts to advance patient safety, quality care, and by being a leader of a healthcare facility.
I think that, you know, we all follow our own path. And my path was to have a blend, if you will, of some of my different life experiences. It was important to me, in particular because I think that, you know, I told you my mom was a nurse, and I had open heart surgery as a kid. I had a lot of exposure to hospitals and healthcare and had an interest in that area. But I think that the commonality amongst my experience and probably many of my colleagues as well is the need to adapt and change. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly healthcare is undergoing a revolution, if you will, in not only the way in which care is delivered, mm-hmm. but the expectations of our patients, what we know now we can do to improve safety and quality. So I hope in some small way I've contributed to that. My fundamental belief is that as a leader, my job is to knock the barriers down for all the folks who deliver care, and how can I help them deliver better high-quality care in an environment which is supportive of them and supportive of our patients.
And that has been Dr. Chip Davis, the president and CEO of Sibley Memorial Hospital, the former vice president of innovation and patient safety at Johns Hopkins Medicine, the former owner of R.O. Davis Construction, and a member of the faculty at Johns Hopkins University, who speaks about putting patients first. He has taken examples from other industries, high reliability industries around the nation, and by standardizing processes and by applying the scientific method to the problem posed by patient safety and quality of care, Chip has addressed multiple needs. He has put the patients first, and then he has done so within the context of a national economic transformation that has seen healthcare become a business. And what has been good for business is what's good for patients. By putting patients first and making sure they have a great experience and that they have better health outcomes, at the end of the day, Chip sees that as his greatest legacy of a means of advancing the public interest. So, Chip, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jordan, for the opportunity.
And this has been episode 152 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'd like to remind you to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com, listen on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And should you wish to communicate with Chip, you can call 240-630-0380 and leave a voicemail that will be emailed to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.